Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is consciousness and where exactly is it located?
And first, when does democracy have a dark side? We'll speak with Professor Michael Mann. Democracy, the idea of governing of, for, and by the people, is a long exalted principle, particularly here in the U.S. But our next guest suggests that democracy may also have a dark side. He suggests that majorities can and do oppress minorities, often in the name of majoritarian democracy. In the worst case scenarios, this has led to murderous ethnic cleansing and ultimately genocide. We're joined now by Professor Michael Mann. Michael Mann teaches sociology at UCLA and has authored several books, including Sources of Social Power, Fascists, and the subject for today, The Dark Side of Democracy. Welcome, Michael Mann.
Thank you for having me, Maria.
Great to have you. So you open your book with historical figures who had allegedly embodied enlightened reason along the line of Thomas Jefferson, for example. And yet Thomas Jefferson and others justified exterminating entire peoples.
Yes, that's right. In fact, we find that with the settler colonies, we find the most direct relationship between democracy and ethnic cleansing, because the greater the level of democracy among the settlers, the more murderous they were towards the native populations. So North America and Australia are really the most exterminatory regimes as far as native peoples are concerned, wiping out about 97% of the Native Americans of this landmass, and slightly less, 95% in Australia. And where imperial governments were stronger and more authoritarian, as in the Spanish Empire, for example, the death rate was less. So we do find people like Thomas Jefferson, the first governor of California, all urging people to get rid of the Indians, and even with almost all of the Native Americans gone, President Theodore Roosevelt declared that extermination was as ultimately beneficial as it was inevitable. So there is quite a history of this settlers who have pretty well functioning forms of democracy for themselves being more murderous towards people that they define as aliens.
And the other thing I found quite interesting is that you say this phenomenon of ethnic cleansing and genocide, it's not really primitive or alien, it's a modern problem.
I think that the desire to get rid of a whole people is modern. Certainly we find many atrocities throughout history, but when we look at things like the atrocities committed by the Babylonians against the Jews, documented in the Old Testament, we see something else. We see them marching in, coming across the first Jewish city, demanding surrender, and if they don't surrender, they will all be killed, so say the Babylonians. They don't surrender, the Babylonians storm the city, they kill all the inhabitants. But that's a military tactic. That's supposed to get them, the other cities, to surrender. And of course, the other cities do. And this kind of practice was normal in earlier history, but the notion of wiping out a whole people is, I think, modern. And the basic reason for that is in previous periods, class distinctions were so great that rulers very rarely considered themselves to be part of the same people as the ordinary peasant. And so they didn't have a very ethnic conception of themselves. And elites in different societies thought of themselves as being closer to each other than they thought of being closer to the masses.
I would think that another reason for this would have to do with something else that you wrote about, which is oftentimes these ethnic cleansings occur when the minority, which may be oppressed, does not submit to the majority. But in the past, it seemed like there were more submissive, when it was more class-based, people submitted a little bit more.
Yes, it didn't matter very much to them whether they were being oppressed by the Jewish upper classes or the Babylonians. Today, there is far more of a common identity between the people and the leaders, and so you have ethnic bonding occurring across class. So, in a way, class conflict, class divisions are a protection against ethnic cleansing.
And which one is worse? Interesting.
Well, in terms of mass murder, I think there's no question that ethnic cleansing is generally the worst, though, of course, you do have these very particular things going on in Soviet Russia and in China, where landlords, kulaks, are slaughtered in very large numbers as enemy classes. But that's very rare.
And in Cambodia?
And in Cambodia, too, you're quite right.
Yeah. Right. One other statistic I thought was striking, and I don't know exactly how this really fits in with your whole thesis, is the civilian deaths in wars and conflicts that, say, in World War I, less than 10% of the deaths were civilian. World War II comes around, it was about half. And now the wars in the 90s, it's like 80% civilian deaths.
Yes, yes, that's right. That's right.
Now, how does this relate to the whole democratic argument?
Well, I think that part of it relates, obviously, to new weapons of war, and especially to aerial bombing. But it's certainly the case that we, the democracies, in winning World War II, for example, did engage in indiscriminate bombing. And I'm not thinking primarily of Hiroshima, which you can debate about that. It was supposed to end the war earlier, and it probably did. But I'm thinking more of the firebombing of Tokyo or Dresden, in which the American and British Air Force as well was deliberately targeting civilians in order to destroy the will of the Japanese and German people. Of course, it didn't really work. But there's no question, as far as the British were concerned, there was a strong element of revenge for German bombing of British cities. So democracies, it depends what you count as atrocities. Democracies, if you bring in wars, have been just as atrocious as anyone else.
Now, if we go into your theoretical arguments here, one of the things you distinguish, which I thought was quite interesting, are these two versions of we the people.
Yes.
You have this liberal version that honors the individual and one that you call organic or whole people that seems to be more about the entire community. Why don't you describe these concepts and give us some examples?
Yes. Well, there are two concepts of the people. There's two Greek origins. Demos, from which we get the democracy words, and ethnos, from which we get ethnicity and ethnic cleansing. And now these are both words for the people, ruled by the people. And the problem comes when the two get confused. If you think of we the people in the United States, we the people actually meant white males. It was also something, it was also a political regime dominated by property owners. And so it didn't actually mean everybody. Whereas in the 19th and 20th century, it became much more likely that people, when talking about we the people, would mean absolutely everybody. And this became bound up with a form of nationalism, whereby everyone who was part of the same ethnic group was considered to have the same culture, the same soul. And that since there was a unitary group, a single ethnic group, the state had to represent that, and minorities could not be full members of this state and so were discriminated against. As you said earlier, it's when the minorities resist that you get real trouble. The normal lot of minorities is to accept discrimination. Maybe they should if it leads to ethnic civil wars and ethnic cleansing.
You know, it's interesting. I was looking through your examples that you argued were evidence of this. And Rwanda, I would like to focus on Rwanda because I was thinking about the ethnic minority, which was the Tutsi people that were essentially annihilated in the genocide, were not really resisting the Hutu power that took the government after the president was assassinated. So can you explain that particular genocide in terms of resistance and laying claims to the same land? Obviously, the Hutu power wanted the land.
Yes.
But it seemed like there was something else to it. And the other thing I want you to address, you talk about how sometimes these genocides and ethnic cleansings are really a plan C, that they don't intend to be genocidal. And I was looking for evidence of this in Rwanda and couldn't quite find it. Can you explain?
Yes, that's two questions, yes. The Tutsis were only 15% of the population, but they were considered by the Belgians, Rwanda was part of their empire, were considered by the Belgians as the natural ruling group, the people with more power, with more abilities, and so they ruled through the Tutsis. And this strengthened the senses of ethnic identity. But in the last years of Belgian rule, there were pressures from Belgium and also from within Rwanda to do more for the Hutus. And after independence, the Hutus came to power. And Tutsis then felt disgruntled. Many of them left the country. Now, it isn't actually true, what you said, that there was no resistance, because There were two things that sparked off the genocide. One was the shooting down of the plane of the president, the Hutu president, presumably by Tutsis.
Yeah, I think that's presumably, though. There's some question about that.
We'll never know for sure, but the balance of probability is that it was indeed Tutsis. The second thing that was going on is there was a Tutsi invasion by the people who'd fled, the Tutsis who'd fled into neighboring Uganda, and they'd been helped by the Ugandan government.
Right, the Rwandan Patriotic Front.
That's right.
But these were not the residents of Rwanda. These were people who had been displaced before, who had come back.
That's right. That's
and
right.
wanted their land back.
Yes, they wanted to win a war and become the new government, and indeed they did. But it's true that the majority of the Tutsis in Rwanda were not resisting, but the Hutus came to believe that these Tutsis were helping the Tutsi invaders. There was a fierce battle going on within the Hutu community, and as a result of the invasion and then the shooting down of the president's plane, the Hutu extremists managed to come to seize power, and as soon as they seized power, they launched the genocide. Let me say that in these 20th century cases, like Rwanda, Yugoslavia, Armenia, these are not democracies doing it, but it is the problem of the democratization process. All of these groups who eventually perpetrated the genocide or ethnic cleansing in these cases were originally seeking a more democratic form of government. And it was when they began to confuse those two senses of democracy, of rule by the people, with a particular ethnic group, that it led towards these terrible atrocities. So I'm not saying in those cases that they were democracies. They obviously weren't, but that it was the democratizing process that led towards.
Is there something in the U.S. that kind of shows an oppressive quality of democracy, of majorities oppressing a minority? But it's not ethnic cleansing. It's just a violation of rights. Prop 8 is the example that I frequently look to, this or maybe in Prop 187 or some of these other propositions. And it really seems to be direct democracy that often is the violating of the minorities.
Yes, well, of course, what direct democracy, what referenda can do is whip up scares and against minorities who seem deviant, and you do get that in the propositions. But I think that, the kinds of terrible atrocities that I'm talking about are in a different league.
They're definitely in a different league.
And I think there is a bright side to what's going on. There is a steady progress of rights in this. Well, not completely steady, but the backlash is unlikely to prevail in the medium term, I would think, because it's clear that society is going in a more human rights direction.
Now, is that because of the kind of democracy that is established here in the United States?
Well, I think it's more general than that. I think that there are social processes going on across the Western world as a whole, and so you have the same kind of thing happening in Europe too now. It's not because there are not referenda in that way. It doesn't have the same drama involved as is the case in California, but there is an advance of these kinds of rights, and I'm not a specialist in this area, but it's obvious that there is a kind of sexual revolution going on and has been going on for some time, and that it partly came out of other human rights, civil rights movements, and that'll probably continue.
Michael Mann, I want to thank you so much for being with us. The book is called The Dark Side of Democracy, Explaining Ethnic Cleansing, and I know I took you a little off track there, and I apologize, but it is something that I've thought about in terms of the dangers of democracy at times whenever the general public decides to violate rights of another. And, of course, you're talking about the extreme version. But I would like to say thank you so much for being with us.
Okay. Thank you very much, Maria.
Michael Mann is a professor at UCLA and the author of The Dark Side of Democracy.
When we come back, what is consciousness and where exactly is it located?
Stay tuned.
Thank you. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guests have been studying the science and nature of consciousness. What exactly does it mean to be conscious? How is this different from our subconscious? Is it just brain activity, or is there more to consciousness? Valerie Gray Hardcastle is professor of philosophy, psychology, and psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati. She is the author of Locating Consciousness, The Myth of Pain, and Constructing the Self. Dr. Rocco Gennaro is professor of philosophy and department chair at the University of Southern Indiana. He is the author of Consciousness, The Consciousness Paradox, and he is editor of Theories of Consciousness and Psychopathology. Hakuan Lau is professor of psychology at University of California, Los Angeles. He is co-author of What is Consciousness and Could Machines Have It? And Empirical Support for Higher Order Theories of Conscious Awareness.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It is great to have the three of you with us to talk about consciousness and what exactly we mean by consciousness. What are the different schools of thought, and why does this really matter to us in our everyday lives? Rocco Gennaro, why don't we start with you? You've sort of outlined these in your book. How would you explain this to us?
I think what most philosophers have in mind, at least by consciousness, is kind of captured by the Thomas Nagel's famous phrase, you know, there's something it's like to be in a mental state, or it's something it's like to be a bat or a human being or whatever. So there is this subjective first person view. Of course, the problem is that, at least for many, it is not necessarily very easy to try to explain that kind of subjective first person point of view with very easily in a kind of neurophysiological or materialistic way. So you have the different views that go back, of course, centuries. You have the sort of broad categories of materialism on the one hand, some sort of materialism where consciousness is basically brain activity or conscious mental states, or brain activity reduced to brain activity. There are a lot of different types of materialist views, though. And then the broad view of dualism, where the mental states or consciousness or your conscious mind is something distinct from your body and perhaps causally interacts with it. But again, there are a lot of different types of dualist views. Maybe just that it can't be reduced to some sort of something physical. And then there are other views, a little more, in my view, a little more eccentric. Panpsychism, for example. You know, that
what is that?
Consciousness is everywhere, and maybe is a property of even the smallest particles and the basic. There has been a bit of a resurgence of interest and defense of it in recent years. Of course, you find that in philosophy in general. It would be hard to obviously summarize briefly all the different other kinds of views. What makes a good question that I kind of tend to think of is, what is it that differentiates an unconscious mental state from a conscious mental state? You know, what's the difference?
Yeah, what would you say to that?
Well, I think there are two different answers. One, you know, some people will go directly to the brain and say, well, looking, you know, the neural correlates of consciousness, there's been a lot of interesting research, a lot of theories, a lot of types of things that have been proposed, but still not any consensus in sort of being able to point to some particular brain property that is solely responsible for consciousness. The different areas of the brain are well understood, most of them at least, of their basic functions. But there's a lot of experimental evidence that at least consciousness, I would think, depends on proper brain functioning. But there's also some resistance, right? It does seem resistant to be able to explain in neurophysiological terms. I guess the other answer, one that I've defended, I don't think this necessarily makes me any less of a materialist, really, but it's at least a way of trying to reduce consciousness without necessarily going directly to neurophysiology, is to defend what's called the higher order thought theory of consciousness. It's just basically the view that when you're in a conscious mental state, as opposed to an unconscious mental state, you're aware of being in that state. There's a higher order awareness, which at least some of us think it's best to understand as a thought. I know Hakuan has some sympathy for it. I know Valerie does not. But on the other hand, there are a lot of overlaps and similarities and different views. Still, I think bottom line, most people who hold that view tend to still think generally, materialistically. It's just that maybe, from my point of view, maybe directly trying to reduce consciousness to something neurophysiological is a little too soon, perhaps, for that. And maybe it's good to think of it in terms of the higher order thought theory. Probably, though, everyone is still trying to explain what allows us to have conscious states, what it even means from a first-person point of view. How can something so subjective be objectively explained in terms of science is the way, in terms of a question or a puzzle, is the way it's sometimes framed, as I think of it, at least.
Well, Valerie Newcastle, let's bring you in. Now, I understood you're also somewhat of a materialist, and I think you also said a naturalist, too, but it sounds like Rocco thinks that you're on different, you know, paradigms on this. So how would you approach this? What do you think consciousness is, and how do we know it? What evidence is there?
Yeah, well, that's the $64,000 question. If I knew that, I'd have a Nobel Prize. On the one hand, you know, you might find ultimately philosophers end up being pretty boring because there's so much that I agree with Rocco in. It's hard to, we kind of disagree around the fringes, but I very much do take reductionistic kind of materialistic approach to trying to understand consciousness, in large part because I don't know how else to think about the world. So I can't claim with great certainty that this is absolutely the right way to proceed, but I can say I don't know how else to do the science of it. And from my perspective, the science of things is the best way that we get understanding of the furniture of our universe. But having said that, I'd like to go back to the very first thing Rocco was talking about, which was the definition of consciousness. And I think what he said is exactly what most people say, and it's in some sense uncontroversial, and it's that first person subjective sense of the world. But the problem is that is not a great definition around which to build some sort of scientific investigation. So then what happens, I think, is people try to carve off little bits and pieces of this first personal type experience. And so they'll ask questions like, why is it that when I see a round ball, a round red ball, the red is exactly the same size as the ball? Because we know that color is processed in one area of the brain and shape is processed in another area of the brain. So how does this come together such that we have like one conscious experience of the round red ball? So that's one question someone might ask. Another question someone might ask is, why is it when we look at our visual world, we see like this, we have this sense that there's this whole world, you know, 180 degree perspective of a visual scene in front of us. When we know the way our eyeballs work is we're kind of darting here and there and we can't actually take in 180 degree scene. So we're filling all this in without actually taking in the sensory data. How do we do that? And then you can ask other questions about taste and sound and touch and nausea and pain and so forth. But then once you start doing that, I think what you end up with, at least that's where I think things are right now, is you have lots of good smaller stories about how these things may or may not happen in the brain or in our psychology. But you lose this sense that consciousness is this one thing that we're going to be explained. It's going to be explained in one way. Maybe it's lots of things that we're going to explain in many different ways. And so it's just going to break down. And so it's just kind of our naive sort of folk view of the world that we're conscious and that's like one thing. And perhaps that's not the best way to approach understanding consciousness at all.
Well, I'm going to have lots of questions that are going to, you know, look into our perceptions that you're describing and reality. Before I do, let's bring Hakuan Lau in. Hakuan Lau, how do you see consciousness?
I think a lot has already been said by Valerie and Rocco, and much of it I agree. The really interesting aspects of consciousness is really the difference between conscious and unconscious processes in the brain, and the former give rise or is somehow associated with a kind of subjective experience. And we can operationalize it by, in terms of some sort of report. When people experience something, presumably they can talk about that experience. Even if not verbally, they can somehow press keys to indicate the intensity of that experience or something like that. Whereas for unconscious processes, they usually do not even know that it happened. It took place in the brain. So accounting for that difference is the challenge here. Rock was right that I think in terms of the philosophical theory that I happen to think is empirically true, that's the higher order theory. It's not necessarily one version of the theory is called the higher order thought theory. It's not necessarily my favorite. Something that is higher order in the sense that the brain mechanism responsible for distinguishing conscious and unconscious processes turn out to be not in the sensory processing areas, and it turned out to be in some sort of self-monitoring type of circuit. I don't think this is the only approach out there. I think in a sense that you can roughly divide the two approaches in terms of software-based approach and hardware-based approach. So I think I take an approach that is more software-based. I think that the difference is something in terms of what the brain computes. That's what distinguishes conscious from unconscious processes. But I think some of our colleagues who take the hardware approach are not entirely crazy either. They would think that, you know, some circuitry just has certain physical properties, such as the dynamics or the complexity or something in those circuits that just give rise to conscious experience. There's nothing you can analyze at the algorithm or computational level. And I respect that. I just think that that happens not to be empirically true. And that has number of, you know, disadvantages of going that route. I see the two as basically life possibilities.
Valerie, I want to bring you back in for a second. There's something I read in your work that argued, I would say, that consciousness is really a dynamic thing, maybe holistic, and that you can't separate it from the environment. How does this work?
I have to say, I'm not actually sure I agree with that perspective, but it was a perspective I did discuss. And so here's roughly the idea. And that is, you know, we are evolved organisms, just like the nematode. And so our sensory capacities, our thought processes, however you want to describe what it's like to be human, are the product of human evolution, which means that we are creatures that evolved with respect to pressures put on us by our environment. Really, the only way to understand how our mind works is to understand us as creatures in a particular environment. So if we go back to our idea of filling in what we see in a visual scene, so we have the sense that we're seeing a 180-degree technicolor view when really, you know, our color processing is essentially in our fovea, our eyes are darting everywhere, there's no way we can actually consume a 180-degree scene. What we're filling in, of course, is compatible with the environment that we've been in. So we use our experiences with the environment to shape how we see and understand things. And so that's roughly where the idea comes from. The suggestion is that if you really want to understand how the human mind works, and of course, consciousness is for many of us a very important aspect of our mind, you're going to have to understand us as being embedded creatures in a particular environment, and that we evolved the way we did because the environment is the way it is. And so if we were raised in a completely different environment, our experiences might be very different, our sensory systems might be very different, and consequently, our conscious experiences might be very different.
I think this was also something you were discussing in the introduction of one of your books, where you said the mind affects the world and the world affects the mind. And
right.
It sounds like you're saying that that is one view that you're not necessarily in agreement with.
I want to say I believe we are evolved creatures. And I certainly do believe that we are going to have to account for us as evolved creatures in the particular environments in which we live to understand human psychology and why we think about things the way we do, why we perceive the world the way we do. Where I disagree with people, I think, is some people then want to say, oh, well, the mind itself is now extended out in our environment because we use it. We use the environment, and you can see this even more today than like when I was a kid. I don't remember anyone's phone number anymore because I have a cell phone that's got a contact list on it. And so I'm just offloading my mind into objects in my environment. So if I really want to understand how my mind computes information, then it's a combination of environmental props and stuff going on inside the head. So some people then want to say, oh, well, the mind itself is outside it in the environment and it's inside the head. And that's the part I'm not quite sure I want to go that far. I think you need both, but I still like to keep, from my perspective, the brain stuff inside the head, and there's skin and other sorts of cells that differentiate the me from the rest of the world. although I do believe you need both to really understand exactly how we function.
All right, well, let's turn to animal studies and animal observations and what this might mean for humans. Are they just like us? Are they conscious like us? Hakuan Lau, you made reference to primates in one of your papers. How do you see this?
I think just as a pragmatic approach, being a neuroscientist, there's just no way you can write off animal models for most of brain functions. And there are those who would think that the higher the functions it gets, this analogy becomes more and more obvious. So in terms of language, for instance, there probably aren't many good animal models. But I think consciousness is one of those that within the realm that you should consider the animal models, at least especially for mammalian brains, for like rodents and that sort of animals with brain structures that are not that different from us. Noting the differences, we can learn a lot from those animals, assuming that they are just as conscious. And so far it has worked. It's not a philosophical assumption that we make that assume is right. I understand that maybe at the end of the day we don't know, but as a pragmatic working assumption, it so far has served us quite well.
So what does observing animals tell us about consciousness? And what does it tell us about whether we are distinct from other animals?
I think in terms of behavior, I think one challenge in trying to relate, most of my lab mostly do either computational modeling or work on human subjects. But when we actually try to learn the physiology, we have to go into animal invasive models and try to draw analogies and parallels. And most of the time, we just find it one of the biggest challenges now that you have to think of a task that would apply the same way to humans and to animals. And as soon as you do it, it kind of helps you to clarify a lot what you mean by consciousness. So let's say you want to try to test whether a rodent is consciously seeing a stimulus or just like sensing it as an automata, what kind of task would tell you the difference? And it comes down to some sort of self-monitoring, really. So if you want to try to say, there are sometimes a rat can see a visual pattern clearly in a conscious sense, then presumably you want to do a kind of task to basically ask the animal or require the animal to kind of rate confidence. So, for instance, a rat can poke his nose into one of the chambers and try to get reward. And if that action is based on seeing something clearly, presumably the animal would wait for a long time to get that reward. Because if the reward is not delivered, the animal presumably is thinking, well, I got it right. How come you're not giving me the reward? And that turned out to be true. So for consciously or for subliminally presented stimuli, the animal would in fact wait for a longer time proportional to the likelihood that the animal get the answer correct. So just like humans. So these kind of, I think just like going through this kind of task or what kind of experiment would allow you to probe conscious versus unconscious perception in animals already tells you a fair bit about what we actually implicitly mean when we say that the human subject is conscious or unconscious. And that kind of relates to Valerie's earlier point. It's kind of, ideally, we want to just get at the subjective experience, but doing experiment, you can't do that. You kind of have to operationalize it in some sort of experiment. And I find these kind of animal studies really useful because when we're dealing with an animal, we can't just go and ask the subject, like, how do you feel? We have to boil it down to some sort of experimental task. And that has been very, very instrumental.
Yeah, it'd be pretty wonderful if they could tell us how they feel. Rocco Gennaro, what would you add?
A lot of the kinds of experiments Hakuan mentions are great. There are plenty of others, right, about testing where they have, you know, episodic memory. Also, even, you know, what is their neurophysiology compared to ours comes in. Can they adjust to a novel situation? Birds and others, I certainly think they're conscious, but it does raise the question mentioned earlier about, you know, if we are biological creatures, of course, to some extent evolved, then we would be viewed more as continuous with them. They don't have a prefrontal cortex, so they're probably not thinking about, you know, the distant future or the galaxy or higher mathematics, or I don't think there are any cat philosophy clubs or anything, you know, anything like that. But on the other hand, that may be because they lack that area of the brain that is probably responsible for it in us. And that seems fairly uncontroversial. I think the problem for someone who's more of a dualist, especially someone who's like a substance dualist, like, you know, going back to Descartes and others, is how do you explain that difference without pointing to the brain? And if you don't think that there's a, you know, a non-physical mind that goes on to eternal life or something for cats, then, you know, it might call into question, why would you think about it for us? So there are these background major philosophical, you know, metaphysical questions that are always lurking.
What does the field say about either, you know, mind-altering, consciousness-altering substances, mental illnesses? Is that all thought to be brain effect?
I think so. There are so many particular psychopathologies, and they result often from very, very specific damage or disturbance of areas of the brain, or even neurochemistry or whatever. And when you start to look at the brain damage evidence and how they so closely are associated with so many kinds of psychopathologies, you know, to me at least, you know, then when you see someone behaved a certain way, or there's this illness, or they don't know what they're, you know, what's happening, it does seem kind of reasonable to me to think there must be something a little different or wrong about, you know, their brains, or, you know, like psychopaths. It seems like it stands to reason. Is there something, area of the brain associated with lack, with empathy? You know, is there damage there? Is it smaller than most? Is it, you know, those kinds of things continue to come up. If you want to use the so-called principle of simplicity that's used sometimes, it just seems like a simpler explanation. It would always be, well, yeah, I mean, the mental damage results from that brain damage because that's where the mental activity just would normally occur, as opposed to a much more involved, say, dualist explanation of somehow a cause between brain and the mind, or something like that.
You know? And would you say similarly the use of, you know, consciousness-altering substances, say, you know, a hallucinogen?
Some of consciousness-altering substances, you know, can cause things that can also be caused by, you know, stimulation to certain areas of the brain. Even things like out-of-body experiences, you stimulate an area of the brain and you have these experiences. Mind-altering drugs can sometimes be caused by a lack of oxygen in the brain, or other kinds of, I don't know about if that's natural, but, you know, a more natural or without taking a drug. So there's a lot of those kinds of things. And, you know, materialists will think of it as, well, you know, that's because they're the same, you know, the mind and the brain. On the other hand, I guess a dualist might say, well, it doesn't really show that. It just shows that they're causally interacting. But that makes things, in my view, a lot more sort of unnecessarily complicated. It just seems like, at least like Valerie said, a more, at least a better methodological way of going about it. And even historically, you know, people used to think that schizophrenia was devil possession or something, right? I mean, nobody believes any. Why? Well, there's a more naturalistic explanation. And, you know, you can go through a lot of things like that and see, well, you know, it seems like a reasonable inference these days. Doesn't mean all the answers, of course. We certainly don't have all the answers, but and there remain some puzzles and problems, of course. But it seems like, at least methodologically, it's a good way to think about it and proceed.
Valerie, what would you say to that?
I think that's exactly right. And we all believe this because when we have a headache, we take aspirin to make the pain go away. And aspirin is just this chemical substance that we're putting in our body. So clearly we think there's this very deep and fundamental connection between chemistry and our conscious experiences. And so I agree with Rocco that if you just want to have like the best and simplest explanation, you're going to agree that yes, chemicals interfere with the chemistry of your neurons. And as a result, that affects how you perceive the world. Or you have some sort of insult or injury to your brain that causes synaptic death or neuronal death. That influences how you experience the world. It's one of those things to me that maybe I've been in this business too long, but it just seems so completely obvious. I have a hard time wrapping my mind around a different perspective.
I wonder too, I think, again, this was something I was reading in one of your books about this idea that, yes, we have this consciousness, it's connected to our physiology, and yet we're not really perceiving reality exactly as it is. Say, for example, you know, this table that I'm sitting in front of course, we perceive it as if it is this hard substance, but really, in fact, it's, you know, this subatomic particles moving around really fast, and it's got this energy to it. And so, you know, there's a consciousness about how things are, but it doesn't necessarily comport with the reality beyond what our perception is. What can we surmise from consciousness in the brain and its limitations there?
If you ask me, I would say that this is just a product of, going back to what I was talking about earlier, of our being a biologically evolved creature. As biological creatures, I mean, what do we need? We need mates to have sex with. We need food. We need shelter. All those are kind of mid-sized objects. And so our sensory system is geared to be able to perceive those things in our environment, as opposed to nanoparticles, which are not going to provide as much sustenance, as it were. And so, you know, just like our visual system has evolved to help us see the things that we care most about our in our environment, birds and bees' visual systems have evolved very differently because they need to perceive very different things in their environment, looking at a wider range of colors, for example, than what we care about. And so I take this sort of evidence that we don't actually see the world the way we think we believe it is with respect to science, just to be a reflection of, well, this is how we evolved to perceive the world to our greatest advantage, to help us survive, to get our genes into the next generation.
Hakuan Lau, what would you say
about the issue of
well, you could address, you could actually address any of these things if you'd like. You could.
So you mentioned about two things, right? One is about whether substance ingestion that gives people psychedelic experiences, whether that would suggest anything that goes beyond the physicalist point of view, whether everything is from the brain. I think that is interesting in the sense that we all seem to agree that it's certainly consciousness is a matter of basically properties of the brain. But just to play devil's advocate, I think there's an interesting notion here that already maybe is more interesting than the physicalist versus dualist perspective, is whether it's really hardware or software. So to many of us, maybe including Rocco, if you think it's your really high order theories, essentially you are saying that consciousness is a cognitive process of some kind. It can be some personal cognitive process, but it's some sort of, you know, computational or information process. And in that sense, you don't necessarily need a brain. You can simulate the process in a computer. And in that sense, then it's interesting whether the physical substrate is actually the quite essential part, or whether the brain just happens to be the hardware implementing the mind as a software. I think that's been very clear to me. I take the approach that I assume that it's software because that's the way to do science. That's the best way to understand brain functions right now, is to try to think of brain's computation and algorithm and try to map the hardware. But I'm not always 100% sure whether the hardware doesn't matter, whether you can actually replace all the neurons with silicon chips. And in that sense, then the drugs may not work for the brain anymore because the chemistry changed. But in that sense, are you the same conscious being? I tend to assume that it isn't in my day job, but I'm not writing it off philosophically. Now, this seems to relate to the second part of the question you asked too, about whether our minds can see illusions. And again, if you take a software perspective, you can see why all those illusions come about. You see the table and it may not be exactly the same as reality. Because if you understand it from a software perspective, your software may just be trying to approximate the computations in the world because you don't have all the brain juices available to you to always do the exact computations that would lead you to a perfect reality. So sometimes you see things as illusory because that might be a kind of like a quick hack that the brain uses. And that seems to be a useful way to understand most of illusions, which is partly why I also like to take this software approach.
You know, one of your papers had a concept in it called metacognition. What is that?
So it's basically very similar to what Rocco earlier talked about, higher order theory. So it's basically to say you have some sort of self monitoring system that monitors other more basic processes in the brain. So for instance, when you see something, your visual cortex analyzes the light patterns and the colors and the orientations and the line edges, etc. So that's first order cognition. And then you have higher order cognition, or what we call metacognition, which is another higher level, monitors what's going on at the basic perceptual engines that take care of analyzing the colors and edges and motion, etc. And that internal monitor is what we think is ultimately crucial for distinguishing between conscious and unconscious processes.
So it sounds like we have agreement that we're essentially physical creatures and that consciousness really is a function of our physicality. Would you say that that's what we're saying?
Yeah, I think we all agree that, yeah, it is physical. But just as a computer is also physical, there's a difference there between a computer and, for instance, your kidney. And if you simulate your kidney, it may not do you much good. Your kidney needs to be physically there to actually do its, you know, biochemical job to filter out the things that you don't want from your blood. And that is a physical job. Whereas your computer, on the other hand, is also a physical artifact. But actually, most of what it does is actually computations, which can be simulated. So you can imagine having a computer that is made of something totally physically different. You can have a computer built of trolleys and pistons and etc. And so long as it does the same computation, it does the same math, does the same algorithm, it will do the same job. So it's not clear to me whether, I mean, it's not entirely clear to me whether consciousness belongs to the software type, like a computer, or whether it's more like a kidney type, that is physical. Being there, having the causal power of connecting to the chemistry and everything is important.
You know, it seems like so much of our lives are actually operated in a sort of semi-conscious state, right? So, you know, perception and that sort of a thing seems to be, you know, maybe even subconscious to some degree. And so much of our psychology seems to be a subconscious state, as opposed to, you know, maybe this is the higher order that you're talking about, where we're actually thinking and we're, you know, analyzing and we're dissecting and we're deconstructing. And so I suppose there is that part of it that becomes a question. And then there's the question of dreams, right? We go into a dream state. What is that? And how are these related? I can see Valerie nodding. The other two of you are on the phone, so I can't actually see you. But Rocco, you were about to say something as well. Do you want to complete that thought? And then I'll go to Valerie since she's nodding.
Just a couple of quick things. I agree with Hakuan about the question about software, hardware, and I'm honestly not sure what to say sometimes about whether machines or other physical types of things could be conscious. I mean, I think other biological creatures, even, you know, alien species that are biological, would be less of an issue, I think. I just don't know, and I'm just not sure what to say about robots and machines, given the way that what they're made of. I don't know how to. I'm inclined to think they couldn't be conscious, but I really don't have a good reason why. I mean, other than the bias, it could be though that there are just some sorts of physical things that can't do certain things, right? I mean, some sorts of physical things can conduct electricity, some can't. It may be that some sorts of physical things can be conscious and some not. I'm just not sure. And on the point about outer perception, where, you know, we often do say and think that we don't really see the world the way it really is and that sort of thing. I mean, I think one of the problems that dualists maybe encounter or end up in is the problem of, well, and maybe Descartes was right, you know, when you think to yourself or you meditate about your own mental state and your own mind, it doesn't seem like a physical thing. I mean, he was right. It seemed like he's right about that. I close my eyes and think about my mind, I'm not aware of, you know, of what I'm, what seems like something physical. On the other hand, you know, someone, we might make the same case that Valerie made earlier about the outer perception that, well, maybe there's a reason when we introspect, think about our own minds, it doesn't appear to be physical, but it still could really be, given mature science, right? It's less controversial when you talk about atoms that make up a table or that sort of thing. But so there is that kind of pushback often. It's sort of the appearance reality distinction applied not only to outer things, but even to our own minds. And I think sometimes a dualist sort of just will take that basic fact that, hey, it sure doesn't seem like my own mind's a physical thing. And I can conceive of it without my body. So, hey, you know, a couple more premises and they must be different, you know, or something like that. And I know, for various reasons, I don't necessarily think those arguments work very well either.
Valerie Hardcastle, let's bring you back in. What about all these sort of semi-conscious states or subconscious states or dream states? And, you know, we're talking about consciousness, not necessarily perception. And isn't perception really relegated to a semi-conscious state? I mean, where do we divide this?
Yeah, well, that's one of those really good questions that I don't think people have good answers for. I mean, I think one thing that's very clear is that a lot of our cognition is unconscious. And that's good, because a lot of what we need to do in this world, we need to do very quickly, and it's like very stupid stuff. So if somebody hits a baseball, it comes flying to our head. We don't need to take the time to analyze that it's actually a baseball. We just need to recognize large looming object, danger, danger, and duck. And so we can do all of that without having, it's only later maybe that we recognize, oh, that was a baseball that was coming at me. And we see this sort of stuff very clearly, in particular with pain. And so, for example, our bodies can recognize that our hand is resting on a hot stove and we have the reflex to remove our hand long before we ever have any conscious experience of pain. And so we can do lots of fast and relatively stupid behavioral things without ever having to engage our consciousness. And so going back to the perspective that Rocco and others take, some people want to argue that, well, we reserve, in a sense, consciousness for like the difficult types of cogitating we have to do. We really have to understand something, our environment. We have to label it as a baseball or as a hot stove, or something of, you know, my loved one, something like that. That's when consciousness, as it were, needs to be engaged, or in fact is engaged, or some such. So, you know, a lot of work has been done, and going back to what people have talked about, that the one way to get into this question is to see, well, what's the difference between a conscious state and an unconscious state? So we can say, well, unconsciously, there's a lot of parallel, very stupid processing. Consciousness seems to be much slower, more deliberate, and serial processing to a certain degree. But then it turns out the more you study unconsciousness, the more robust it appears. And there are certainly psychologists out there who want to argue that when you get right down to it, it seems like not only can our unconsciousness do all the stupid stuff, but it also can have really sophisticated interpretations of the world that just never make it into consciousness, as it were, whatever that metaphorically means. So I think these are really difficult questions. And even if you take the attitude that the way into understanding consciousness is try to understand the difference between conscious and unconscious states, I think at this point in our science, we are having a really, really tough time drawing that line.
I suppose also one of the big questions that arises with this is also, you know, in a contemplative state, which can sometimes be kind of semi-conscious, introspective state, a lot of profound ideas emerge from this. You know, a lot of profound science has come from this. A lot of profound philosophy has come from this. You know, what's the difference here between like this conscious thinking and this kind of stream of conscious, partially aware of yourself, and an idea springs forward?
You know, a lot of this has to do with how psychologists understand problem solving, from my perspective. And one of the things we can do if we're trying to consciously work on something, we in effect get into a rut. And so one thing that happens, like, you know, I get great ideas in the shower because I'm like focused on shampooing my hair, and all at once the solution, the problem that was driving me crazy last night, pops into my head. So what's going on? Well, by doing something else, like shampooing my hair or taking a walk or playing with my dog or something like that, I'm disrupting my consciousness. Basically, I'm getting my consciousness to shut up. And this goes back to what I was talking about earlier, like how sophisticated is our unconsciousness? And so I think it's really sophisticated, and it continues to chew on this problem unconstrained by sort of this kind of serial processing that our consciousness kind of forces on us just by its very nature and structure. Not that I have good ideas what that means either. And so you have this sense that, oh, I've been daydreaming, and suddenly, poof, the answer springs into my head. But really, your brain's been chewing on this just outside of your conscious awareness for a while until it hits upon the solution, which then it, you know, you can then pay attention to and become aware of.
Yeah, this is Rocco. I think some of it could also have to do with maybe the role of attention, you know?
Yeah.
Is that, you know, the more we attend to something, the more, you know, you might say the more you have to be conscious, many people will say. So I agree with what Valerie's saying about maybe there's more to what's going on unconsciously than we had thought. But you could also look at it perhaps the other way around, too. In other words, from the other direction. So, you know, I drive to work. The first three times I drove to my office after we moved here, you know, 8 years ago, whenever that was, you know, I had to look at signs. I had to pay more attention. I had to look around, you know. Now you kind of, just like most people, long distance truck driver type case, you know, you've been down this road, you kind of do it automatically. It's not like, I wouldn't say that you're unconscious. You're just not paying as much attention. You know, I mean, it's not like you become blind, right? That would be kind of dangerous. So you still see if something maybe surprising comes up or different, there's work on the road or there's something, a detour, you'll have to focus more. And so sometimes also there are a lot of everyday conscious, you know, things we do all the time, routine, getting dressed. There's, you might not even remember half of it. But there's also certainly, as Valerie said, probably a lot more going on unconsciously. And some things just pop up into consciousness, and you have an idea kind of sometimes comes out of nowhere. It does. It seems like it, at least, right?
Hakuan Lau.
It's actually surprising to have three researchers working on this topic of consciousness.
Yeah, how'd that happen?
It's actually quite surprising. I mean, I must say, even though we seem to collectively write off panpsychism or dualism here, I have colleagues in the field, and it's very prominent, and they somewhat represent the public media mandate, and they would say these things that we don't agree here. But despite that, I think it's true that most of the active researchers in the field recognize the same issues, that we taking this materialist or physicalist approach and trying to understand consciousness in terms of cognitive neuroscience is the way to go, because there's already so much work we need to do. So much of what we already said here, some of it is still ongoing research. How much can we unconsciously do? Whether the physical substrate is really not as important. So for instance, in Rocco, he's a higher order theory. So in a sense that it should be all about the computation. But when you look at a machine that does all the same computation, it's the same kind of hesitation I have, whether you want to ascribe consciousness to a machine. So these are tough problems, both conceptual and empirical, that we still need to work on.
Well, thank you very much, Rocco Gennaro, Valerie Hardcastle, Hakuan Lau. It's just been a great pleasure to host you. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great.
Thank
Thanks for the
much.
Invitation.
Valerie Gray Hardcastle is professor of philosophy, psychology, and psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati. She is the author of Locating Consciousness, The Myth of Pain, and Constructing the Self. Dr. Rocco Gennaro is professor of philosophy and department chair at the University of Southern Indiana. He is the author of Consciousness, The Consciousness Paradox, and he is editor of Theories of Consciousness and Psychopathology. Hakuan Lau is professor of psychology at University of California, Los Angeles. He is co-author of What is Consciousness and Could Machines Have It? And Empirical Support for Higher Order Theories of Conscious Awareness.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.